We end up in Waco. And to this day, I still can't figure out why we came through Waco. Now, my dad lived to be almost 101. And I asked him virtually every year, Dad, you lined up that trip. He said, Son, I did not do that. Now, that's a Baptist minister, and he's got long, not long to live. So I guess he's telling the truth, but it's so ironic. So we arrived and we stopped by the bear pit where they have the bears. And I looked across the street, it was a gymnasium. And I said, I think I'll go look in the gym, see what it looks like. And I walked across the street, immediately entered the gym. This big, good-looking guy, almost looked like Superman, walked over and introduced himself. He says, I'm Coach Jack Wilson. Who are you?
Track and field world, you are now tuned in to our humble servant, Mike Cunningham, for another extraordinary message on Gill Athletics Connections.
All right, welcome back to the Gill Connections podcast. You know, we are in season five, which absolutely boggles me. Never knew that we would see a season five, and we started this back in 2020. So we're super excited to continue bringing you coaches and uplifting and honoring their great journeys in this profession. As we kick off season five, we're doing something special. This is kind of the end cap. This is our anchor leg, if you will, of the 4x4. We're doing an all Baylor January here in 2024. And so you've heard the first three guests that we've had this season and their Baylor connections. Well, it doesn't make sense to talk about Baylor if we don't talk about the grand poobah of them all. So help me welcome from Baylor University, the wise, the wonderful Mr. Clyde Hart. Coach, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, right? I got to figure out how to get something off my screen here.
All right, no problem. We all need a personal IT department when we do these things. So, Coach, first of all, thank you so much for being here. You hold a special place in a lot of people's hearts, including mine, some very important people for us right here at Gill Athletics. So it really is an honor to be able to sit down and talk with you and kind of learn your journey in this amazing profession. So first, just want to say thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
So, Coach, you know, you've had a long, amazing career. And I think a lot of people think they know a lot of the story when you talk about 4x4, you and all that kind of stuff. Let's get in our Wayback Machines. Where does coaching start for you? Was it as an athlete? Was there a coach that influenced you to come out and become a professional coach in the ranks? Where does it start for you?
Well, actually, it started kind of anywhere but coaching. I got a business degree from Baylor. I kind of in the back of my mind and thought about coaching, but primarily my mother kept saying, no, you need to get out of the business world. That's where a career can be. And she didn't have a very high esteem of coaching. She thought coaching was pretty common. My dad, to the contrary, didn't feel that way. But I didn't have real good experience with coaches, particularly in track and field. I had some good coaches in football. They were good people, but I never really had a coach in what we call in Arkansas. We had junior high, and I won the state championship in three events, which won the state championship for our school just by myself. But I didn't have a coach. We had a tennis coach that and was a real good tennis player and a good guy. He took us to the meets, but he knew nothing about track and field. Well, when I got into high school, it was exactly the same thing, but even to a lesser degree, because I didn't really have anybody that went with me on to the meets. I would get on an Arkansas Trailway bus and go up to Fayetteville and run on a track meet or whatever. And the only coach, I had about an hour of coaching all through my career in high school, and that was my dad took me over to Conway, Arkansas, Hendricks College, had a physical education professor, head of the department, that was known to be a real good track coach. And my dad called him and took me over there. And he spent a good hour primarily telling me and showing me how to start properly. I had no starting blocks. he suggested I need to get some starting blocks. I was digging my holes in the ground, like a lot of people were back in the early before Gil started making the starting blocks. But anyhow, that's the only time I really had anybody with track and field. But I would go up to the school library in Hot Springs High School in Arkansas, and I would get the magazine, Scholastic Coach, I remember, and there was another one or two. I always had articles on track and field, and occasionally, and I was a good friend with the library and the nice lady, and she knew I had an interest, and she ordered some books, and I would read cover to cover different track books. And that's basically what I would do. And I remember each year, Scholastic Coach, I'm pretty sure that's the one, would always have an issue that would summarize the year in track and field in high school. It had all the states, it had all the winners and the times and all that, and ranked them. And I couldn't wait to see that. Well, Arkansas, our state record, this talking about 100 yards, was 9.9. Well, I would look over there and Texas, here's some kid running 9.5, and California, somebody running, and other states were running about like we were. But it was pretty shocking to me to know what I had to do. But I was fortunate enough to win the state in Arkansas, and I did run a 9.9 at the University of Arkansas, which equaled the state record. And an oddity happened that to this day, I don't know, I assume it was legal under NCAA rules. Today, it wouldn't be. But I got a phone call when I was a senior, and I had not even started working out the track yet. I'd been playing football, some basketball, and this was my senior year, and I had won state the previous year. My uncle, who lived in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Uncle Nelson, who was a graduate of LSU, called my dad and told him to get me on a bus to come to Baton Rouge, that he had me a full scholarship to LSU. Well, of course, that was a great thing and unbelievable, because I hadn't been contacted by anybody. The University of Arkansas at that time really wasn't doing anything in track and field. So anyhow, my dad put me on a bus, and I remember drove all day, and I remember for lunch I had a Dr. Pepper and a moon pie, I think, and some peanuts, and I get into Baton Rouge late, spend the night there with my uncle, and the next morning we get up bright and early and go out to the campus, which just I was awestruck. I mean, it was a beautiful campus, huge, and the great big stadium that seated 100,000, which is three times the size of Hot Springs. So I was just in awe. Well, he takes me into the dressing room, and I'm expecting this coach to welcome me and blah, blah, blah. Well, we finally locate the coach, but there was a lot of activity going on. Well, they're getting ready to have a track meet. And all the kids were in the locker room putting on stuff. Well, my uncle finally found Coach Al Morrow. He was a track coach. Nice gentleman, big, tall, nice guy. And my uncle goes over and kind of actually butts in, gets his attention. And the guy was very nice, but I could tell his mind was on other things. And as a coach, I can understand that now. And my uncle introduced me to Coach Morrow, and I could tell then he didn't know me from anything. And my uncle said, this is the young man that I wanted to bring to you. He was state champion up in Arkansas, blah, blah, blah. He's really 9.9. And Coach Morrow said, well, that's good. But we got a track meet going on here in about an hour. And maybe after the meet's over, I'll have time to visit with you. Well, I was just chest falling, you know. I was impressioned that my uncle had given my dad was that I had him already scholarship. Well, I should have known that. Well, then the mistake happened. My uncle then says, well, coach, can he run in the track meet? Well, this is a college track meet. And I said, Uncle Nelson, this is not a high school meet. And Coach Morrow said, oh, yeah. Said, you know, he can run in the junior varsity. That's freshmen and guys at night quiet, whatever. And all the time I'm trying to say, I have not put on a pair of track shoes since a year ago. And, you know, whatever. Well, I can't dissuade them. So I guess it was a good opportunity to have a little trial. And now today, MCA would never allow that. And I don't know if they allowed it then. But anyhow, it happened. So I got a pair of old gray flannel oversized shorts and a T-shirt and a pair of shoes that almost fit. And I was ready to go. No sweatshirt, nothing. So I go into that stadium, and I'm all by the sides. There wasn't that many people in there, but it's huge. The track is no longer in that stadium, but it was at that time. And so sure enough, I line up, and there's guys from what I call those directional schools in Louisiana, Northeast, Southeast, all of them, Tulane, LSU, they were all in my heat. I didn't know from Adam. I imagine they're looking on, who is this kid and this stuff? Well, anyhow, to make a happy story, I win the race.
Okay, good.
And when I hit the finish line, the varsity had already run. And the varsity guy, I remember him running 9900. And when I finished, I noticed Coach Morrow hustle out on the track, put his arm around me, started talking to me, and said, now, I talk about that scholarship. I do have a scholarship, 4 years, full scholarship. I'll have the papers, and we'll have them when we meet. And I said, Coach, what did I run? He said, well, you ran 9.8. Well, that was better than the state, but had not run, I promise you. Not maybe one about practice all that time. And I guess I was so fresh and so excited, but around 9.8, of course, it could never be a state record because it was not a legal race. But anyhow, so I got a full four-year scholarship to LSU. Well, all during the spring, I kept getting letters from Coach Morrow telling how excited he was for me to come the next year. But at the same time, I would occasionally get a letter from the football coach, Gaynell Tinsley, and it would say, all practice starts so-and-so, blah, 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 blah. Well, I discarded it. Finally, after a while, I contacted Coach Morrow and said, I keep getting these letters from football, and I don't intend to play football. I only weighed about 145 pounds, and you were going both ways then, as I did in high school, but I just didn't figure I was ready for that. And he said, oh, ignore that. He's just trying to get an extra body out there. And that may be true. Well, later in the year, that summer, I'm still going to LSU. Well, my dad, who was a Baptist minister, he was on a committee to put another Baptist encampment. We had Ridgecrest, which is a huge Baptist encampment over in the Carolinas, but there was nothing in any part of the United States for the western part. So there was a three-minister committee to pick a site. And he had gone to Louisiana and looked at a site. He had gone to Oklahoma, maybe one in Arkansas. But anyhow, we were headed to Santa Fe, New Mexico, which ended up becoming Glorieta Baptist Encampment, which is unbelievable. But anyhow, we're on our way. Well, on the way there, driving with my mom, my dad, he said, well, we're right on our way to Waco. Let's just stop and see what Baylor looks like. My dad was a graduate of Wichita Baptist College. He never pushed me towards Baylor, although we occasionally had Baylor athletes come to our church and hold revivals. And so I had met him and was impressed with him, an All-American name. Jackie Robinson played on the 48 Olympic team in basketball, and Jerry Cooney, who's an All-Southwest Conference back. But anyhow, we end up in Waco. And to this day, I still can't figure out why we came through Waco. Now, my dad lived to be almost 101, and I ask him virtually every year, Dad, you lined up that trip. He said, son, I did not do that. Now, that's a Baptist minister, and he's got not long to live. So I guess he's telling the truth, but it's so ironic. So we arrived, and we stopped by the bear pit where we may have the Baylor Bears. And I looked across the street. It was a gymnasium. And I said, I think I'll go look in the gym, see what it looks like. And I walked across the street. Immediately entered the gym, this big, good-looking guy, almost looked like Superman, walked over and introduced himself to me. He says, I'm Coach Jack Wilson. Who are you? And I told him, he said, you're from Hot Springs. And I said, uh-oh, something wrong. I said, yeah. He said, well, we were going to recruit you, but then we got word you'd already signed with LSU. And so we were really disappointed. But if you're ever not happy, you know, you can give me a call. And he gave me a card. And in those days, you didn't have a national letter sign. It was all by conferences. So I decided, well, I'll just walk around. So I walked around the campus and met some other people. And it was a totally different atmosphere than LSU. And that's not a bad thing for LSU, just different. They were huge, big state school with lots of things. Baylor was smaller, a lot of friendly kids. And back in those days, at least I thought, you had some loyalty. If you were a Baptist, I kind of felt like Baptist kids ought to go to Baptist schools. Catholic kids ought to be at Notre Dame. Well, that proved not to be true because my senior year at Baylor, the captain of our football team was named C.O. Bacata. He was a Catholic. And at LSU, I mean, at Notre Dame, the guy named Leon Hart, no kidding me, was Baptist, and he was captain of Notre Dame. So I thought, well, that theory's out the window. But anyhow, so about halfway to Santa Fe, I tell my dad, pull over, I want to make a phone call. And that's when I called Coach Wilson. He said, yeah, I've got a scholarship, and that's how I came to Baylor. It just hit me that that's where I needed to be. And, of course, I spent 4 years as an undergrad, and I spent 56 years as a coach here. So that's 60 years of my life. I met my wife there, and she became a professor. And neither one of us were business majors, and we graduated. Now, getting back to the original story. Now, if this is getting boring,
this is amazing. The only question I do have, though, because I know your character, did you call the LSU coach and let him know?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, he had to be devastated.
And understood, said, well, I understand you being Baptist and whatever, and it was a quick deal. And he said, you know, I came on to you awful strong after you ran that time. I said, well, I appreciated it. But I want to bring something up because I think it's ironic. My dad, as I mentioned, was a Baptist minister. He graduated from a little place called Crossett, Arkansas, and which was owned by a lumber company, International Paper Company. Mm-hmm. The whole town, you hear about the company town. Well, that was a company town. Every building in that town was made out of wood. It was all painted gray, called Crossett Gray, with a huge paper mill there and everything. And there was one store, and it had everything in it. The high school was framed high school, beautiful, had a swimming pool. Nowhere else in Arkansas, although it was one of the smaller schools in Arkansas, had a swimming pool. They had money. But anyhow, Dad graduated. He had played basketball, played football, and he graduated number one in his class. So they offered him out of high school a job with International Paper Company. But he had to go to St. Louis to business school and take some courses that they needed to help him. Yes, but to back up just a hair, that winter, his senior year, Crossett made to the state tournament in basketball, the smallest school in Arkansas playing Pine Bluff, which was one of the largest. Well, anyhow, a guy ran under him and he broke his arm. So it knocked him out of the game. He was called a shooting guard. So his arm is healed. Now he's on the train going to St. Louis. But in the meanwhile, he had been going to church with my mom, who was Baptist, and he was Presbyterian. So he's going to Baptist church. And he had been feeling the call to go into the ministry. You hear about that, people getting the call. And he was fighting it and was turning it down. It's kind of like me turning down coaching to go in business. He was turning it down to go into business. Well, anyhow, his arm is well, he's on the train to St. Louis, it derails, and he breaks his arm again.
What? So
he came back home and said, I'm not going to fight it anymore. I'm going to Washington, and I'm going to be a preacher.
I was about to say, that's God telling you.
That's right.
I'll break it twice if I have to.
So I'm setting up my part of this. So I go to work for Standard Oil Company out in West Texas. Got a great job right out of college. My wife got a job there also. And doing well, but you had to put in 6 months learning everything about the oil business. So you would spend a while in the warehouse. You'd put part-time in the office. You would go out into the field. You'd be a roustabout, a roughneck. Everything you had in the oil business, you're going to learn. You're going to be part of the boys. Well, one particular day, I was assigned to go up on top of a pumping unit that was a tall one. I mean, really huge. And I'm up there and we're installing what they call the horse's head on the end of the pumping arm of the top. And I'll cut to the chase. A drunk guy below in a truck, supposed to swing this thing up and me catch it, hook it on the end. But then he missed, he clipped some cables and it flipped me up in the air. And I landed and tore up my right arm, dislocated it. Lucky it didn't kill me because I landed right between two big wooden braces that they had below. But anyhow, so my arm's in the cast and I'm still working, whatever. And in the meanwhile, I tell my wife, I said, you know, I think I'd like to coach. She said, what do you think of? And I said, well, I hurt this arm. It's giving me some time to think about things. But I've been going over to the high school after work, and I've been helping the football coach over there with the kids and on the track team. And that guy's name is Truman Nix. And I said, I really enjoy doing it. And I think if I can find a job, I think that that's what I'm going to try to do. And so I put out some feelers. I had a brother-in-law that was superintendent of schools down in the Houston area. And he had said, well, I can get you into a junior high, but you got to work towards getting a teacher certificate and all that. And I said, well, I'll do that. Well, in the meanwhile, I get a call from my dad, and he said, well, listen, the track job in Little Rock Central High School is open. The coach just left to be the head track coach at the University of Tulsa. And I said, Dad, you don't understand. I don't have any experience. I don't have a teacher certificate. I don't have a teaching subject. So there's no way on this world I could get the job at Little Rock Central. That's the top job in the state of Arkansas and one of them in the South. And he said, well, if you could get an interview, would you come interview? And I said, yeah, that's a waste of time. I said, that's 800 miles from where I am right now. He said, well, I got you an interview. I said, you're kidding me. He said, nope. And this was like a Wednesday. He said, it's for Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. In Little Rock. And I said, Dad, I get off work at 5. If I drive all the way through Maxine and I, we can get to Little Rock nonstop probably by 8 o'clock. And that's what I did.
Wow.
We get in the old car and we drive Maxine and I, and we get Little Rock in time for me to pull over to a service station and change shirts and shave and look halfway presentable. And I go in and meet Dr. Virgil Blossom. Now, that guy turned out to be a legend. He ended up being superintendent. Well, of course, that was 1957. My first year was at Little Rock Central, and that was from the Little Rock Nine and integration. And
oh, yeah.
All of that. So I got broke in real, real good. But anyhow, my interview with Dr. Blossom, I leveled with him. I said, Dr. Blossom, I appreciate you interviewing me. I have run track all my life. I think I could coach it. I think I know what it's about. And I will learn all the other events. I said, I know about sprinting and that, but I think I can do it. And he said, well, we've got an extension center here. The Little Rock University of Arkansas has an extension center. You can take some courses out there and work towards getting that teacher certificate. I'll let you go ahead and do practice teaching this summer. We'll get that out of the way. I mean, he was going to let me do that. And that's supposed to be the last thing you do after.
Right.
We'll get the practice. And then I'll give you a temporary teacher certificate that'd be good until you can get your all your hours in, and then take some hours towards you, whatever you want to teach, and you'll be track coach. And also you have to be the athletic trainer. Well, now I got to really fight this. I said, athletic trainer. He said, yeah. Well, I spent some time in the training room. I knew basically how to tape ankles, and I knew other stuff, and I knew that. And I said, just told myself, I can learn that. I got all summer to get me some medical books. So anyhow, before I know it, he just picks up the phone and calls the principal at Central High, Jess Matthews, says, Jess, it's no use going through Harry Carter, that athletic director. I've just hired your track coach. And said, he and his wife are going to come by there in about an hour, and you can show them around. So that's how I got my job at Little Rock Central High.
And you're dead tired at this time, by the way. You've driven all night.
I've driven all. Listen, and that's not the only story. About, I don't know, 4 o'clock in the morning, 3 or 4 o'clock, we weren't even in Texarkana yet. And my wife said, you know, I don't think our lights are on. I said, they got to be on. It was a full moon. I mean, the moon was almost touching the ground. And I said, you know, you may be right. I don't know how long the lights have been out. We've driven, there was no interstate. We've driven those country roads. I stopped the car. Sure enough, we had no lights. And it's still 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I said, oh my gosh, we're not going to make it for the interview. And I look up and there's a farmhouse up a hill, a porch light on. I said, man, I go knock on that guy's door 2 in the morning. He's allowed to shoot. But I had no choice. And I did. And this guy comes to the door and he's got his overalls on. And he's not mad. He understands. And he said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I own a Texaco station about 8 miles up the highway. And I'll meet you up there. And we'll see what's the matter with that car. And I said,
wow.
2 o'clock in the morning. He said, sure. So we do that. We go up there. He raises the hood and he says, you're in luck. It's your fan belt. No, it's your generator belt on your generator, and it's not producing the power. And he said, I think I got one. He goes in and he finds the right size, which is a miracle, puts it on, and then the guy won't charge me. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, you young couple need to go get that job. So we make it. And got the job and stayed there 6 years and survived that first year with the 101 Airborne in there. And the next year, we were closed the whole year, never had one day of school. Though we played a full football schedule of 12 games without a day of school. So the coaches were there, and we went from 110 football players to 27 on Thanksgiving Day. Oh. And that's only because they had credits to graduate or they were taking correspondence courses. So I learned a lot. We were dressing kids out in football that would have been our managers and our student trainers that maybe had played in junior high. Now they're going to play on Friday night in the biggest division in Arkansas. And you know what? It's the biggest lesson I probably learned in coaching, that you don't always have to depend on the number ones or twos or threes. There's other kids that have been pegged as not being able to participate, and they maybe haven't been given the opportunity. But we ended up tying the team that won the state championship after losing 3-4 games in a row by a huge score. We finally got those final 27 kids to understand what we were doing. And we tied, I think it was Pine Bluff for the state. You know, they won state, but we did tie them. But anyhow, that was a good experience. And then the year after, schools opened up like nothing ever happened and went on, and I was able to win the state championship every year up there. And even after the year we were closed, all my kids left and went all over everywhere. Some of them came back, some didn't. And we were not favored at all to win state that year. But we were able to find kids and get them out and train them, and we won the state that year. So that's basically how I got into coaching. And then Coach Patterson, who had been my coach at Baylor. Now, backing up, like I said, I never had a coach in high school track. I get to Baylor, Coach Wilson, the guy that I'd met, track coach, he was also the defensive backfield coach on the football team and had been an All-American, one of the greatest guys I've ever known. But he was a shot putter, javelin thrower, and he would come over, and he was assigned a job coaching track. Here again, I found no one that really knows other than what maybe they've read or hoped to know. For 3 years, I didn't really improve that much. And then my senior year, Baylor finally made a commitment to hire a full-time track coach, and they hired Jack Patterson, who had been at the University of Houston and developed a tremendous record there as developing particularly relay teams and sprinters. He had been a great hurdler at Rice and missed making the Olympics because of the war. Well, he shows up my senior year, and that just everything changed. We went from the bottom of the league in track and field with 13 kids is all we had on the track team at Baylor, and he got us to finish second at the conference meet. Wow. And we equaled the world record in the Formula One relay, and we won the Triple Crown in the Formula Two relay. And I ran a 9.300, win-aided, which was the all-time best ever in the state of Arkansas, and is the Baylor school record in the 100 yards. But so that probably was in the back of my mind. I when I was in West Texas, I had that broken arm time to think and saw how I enjoyed coaching. I remember how Coach Patterson, that one guy, took a bunch of guys that had been also runs and made us into really good track people. I thought, if one person can do that, that's worth doing. And I said, I don't want to sit around 8 hours a day shuffling papers. If I can go out and do something that's going to be lasting, that's what I want. I want a job that I feel like that I've made a difference. And I think that's what I have and I'm most proud about. So that's how I got into coaching. My broken arm, the inspiration of Coach Patterson, and then getting the break at Little Rock Central, I was very lucky. I really have never applied for a job. I didn't apply for one at Little Rock. I was asked to get interviewed. I never applied for the one at Baylor. When Coach Patterson was very successful at Baylor, got the offer to go to the University of Texas with unlimited money and scholarships, he jumped at the chance. I don't blame him. But John Bridges, who was the athletic director and football coach at Baylor, called me and told me Coach Pat was leaving and he wanted to interview me up at the track championships in Federal. They were having a conference meet at the University of Arkansas. And I met him up there along with my wife, and he offered me the job. And I was Baylor 56 years after that.
Coach, that's amazing. Because, you know, as you were telling the story, which was phenomenal, by the way, did you ever go back to the guy who answered the door at 2 o'clock? And
no, and I wished I could find him.
Yeah, right.
Well, that, you know, we lived in the day, and I always tell people, everybody thinks they lived in the best of times. You know, the 50s and the 60s, each 40s, that they were good people. That guy, he didn't hesitate. He recognized that I probably didn't have the money to spare.
Right.
I don't know how much a fan belt he probably did. It may have been a used one, all I know. But for him to get up, never complain, no old pickup down there, and he took care of us. And we didn't lose 30 minutes. And if we lost much more, we'd have been in trouble.
You know, we're on episode 250-something, so 200 and plus coaches. And everybody's origin story and how they got into coaching is so unique. As you were telling your story, you know, there was no central figure of like, oh man, you know, Coach so-and-so really believed in me, or Coach changed my life. And then Coach Patterson arrives, because I was waiting. I was like, there's got to be someone that, you know, showed you that coach track can be not just running fast. It can be transformational with teams and for people's lives. So I was waiting for the Coach Patterson punchline there. And I was so happy to hear what he did that last year for Baylor with the team. I mean, that's quite an amazing turnaround.
Yes. Well, he made a difference. There was no doubt about it.
Do you think his difference was – what percentage of that difference do you attribute to the training principle of I actually had a coach, you know, sprinters and hurdlers and such, versus the way he coached as, I'm not sure how to put this, his belief in you, you know, that's beyond X's and O's. How much was X's and O's, and how much was organization and belief in the team and the kids?
Well, I think Coach Patterson, the difference was, I'm sure he was more knowledgeable in the coaching area. He had more experience than Coach Wilson. But the biggest thing is, we felt like we finally had somebody that cared about us, and that his interest was solely the track team. And I think that's the main thing that we were. But he was just a real gentleman, and we had, of course, coming here with a reputation from the University of Houston, which we knew that they had been great. So we felt like, it, man, he's going to make us good, and he did.
So you get to Baylor, and now you spend 56 years at Baylor, right? 56?
Yes.
That alone is phenomenal. I remember a few years ago, a few of us and some coaches were sitting around talking about coaches who had been at their program for a length of time. You know, people like Curtis Fry came up, you came up, Mouse now, you know, the longevity's head at Florida. But we got to about 10 and we're out of ideas, because, you know, there's not so many coaches that have been there for five, going on six decades. Take us through, kind of give us the 30,000 foot level over those 56 years. We know some of the history, right? We know the Michael Johnsons, Jeremy Warners, and things like that. But where was Baylor when you got there, and how did you transform it to what we know as Baylor 400 meter U?
Yeah. Well, track and field has evolved so differently. When I came to Baylor, Coach Patterson had elevated the track pool. I came into a good track pool. They had won conference championships in track and field, but the University of Texas obviously was down, and that's the reason they stole Coach Patterson from Baylor, because he was successful at Baylor, and they figured, well, we get him with our resources. And so that became my biggest opponent, was my former coach, because not only was he a great coach, but now he's got the state championship all held on his track, and he's got the big stadium, got the money, and did a great job. But the thing that changed is scholarships. When I came to Baylor, I had 20 scholarships, only had the men's program. The other schools in the conference pretty much were the same, except for Texas A&M, and Rice. They had unlimited. Texas, and I asked several times how many scholarships they have, whatever they want. I think A&M had around 30. Rice had a foundation with a bunch of money, and they were doing some outside scholarships. So those three teams were the ones I had to beat each year. Because my scholarship, you have 20 events to put out on the track. It's very difficult. Now, over the years, those scholarships with the NCAA cutback, the adding of women into track and field, right now, men have a little over 12 scholarships. And at a private school, where it's costing $60,000 plus to go to Baylor, and it's costing less than $30,000 goes to the state schools, it's very difficult to compete in numbers. So I had to decide somewhere along the way. So we were very competitive conference championships. I won conference championships team-wise. But I could see early that I was going to have to aim more for the national, because you don't have to have the numbers to be more competitive nationally. So many years, in fact, a lot of years, we didn't win the conference, but we would go to the national meet and we would finish as the top team from our conference. That happened virtually every year for a long time. We finished in the top four at the NCAA team-wise seven times. And three of those were as high as third place. One of them really should have been national runner-up team-wise, because TCU was disqualified because of, some things they did wrong, and they lost all but two of their points, which point wise moved us up in second place. But NCAA never elevates, which means you're punishing two teams instead of one,
right?
Which makes no sense. So we had second highest score that year, 2001, I believe. We still got the third place trophy, so we were doing well team wise because I was concentrating where I could get the points. And that's why, if the NCAA would do what most high schools do, would double the relay points, we probably would have won.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how many team national championships. Because we won, 23 national championships in the 4x4 relay and got the same number of points as the shot putter got. Or if the team had two shot putters, they outscored our 4x4 relay. And there was years that we scored. Well, I remember one year that we finished third at Duke when Michael Johnson was a senior. We won the 4x4 relay, and we were third in the 4x1 relay. Barely missed winning it. It was tight, and yet we got a team over here with three pole vaulters or three snake. They outscored all of what we did. Mm-hmm. So I tell you a funny story. I do have a book that one of these days I think is going to get out. It's all written. It just needs to be proofed. And the guy helping me with it is writing it. He's a sports writer here in Waco, the best in the state of Texas, Bryce Cherry. So we got the rough draft, but he's just hard to get free time to finish it up. But one of the things I mentioned in that was in the Southwest Conference, we always scored the relays exactly the way that we scored the NCAA, same points. You won the 4x4 relay with four people. You got the same as the guy winning the shot put or the discus, whatever. Well, and so there were years we were winning both of them, but we were not gaining that much. So 1 year, they decided they're going to double the relays, the points. Well, lo and behold, we go up to the meet, and at SMU, they don't have it 7 lanes on their track. In order to get 8 lanes, because there's 8 schools running where they want to run prelims and the relays, they shorten up their lanes from 42-inch lanes to 36-inch lanes. Well, a guy from, I think it was maybe even SMU, in the lane outside our second runner, his rear end was all the way over into our lane. When our guy took the turn and turned around, they collided. And we fell, got 0 points. And they're doubling them. That's going to be 20 points. We lose it. We lose the meet by, I think, 2 or 3 points.
Oh.
We win the 4x1 relay. No, I mean, we lost the 4x1 relay to 0 points. And the 4x4, Rice has got the top 4x4 relay team in the nation that year. We finished second to him. And Rice wins the conference championship. Next year, guess what? They decided to go back to scoring it the same way. We win both relays and lose again about 6 points. So if you flop the years around, we win 2 conference championships. So that just tells you fate makes a big difference in what you're doing. Timing is important in most everything you do.
Yeah. How did you transform Baylor into 400 meter U? Give us a history lesson. For a guy like me, I think of Michael Johnson as the guy that starts it. And there's many, many history of Deion Minor, Mike Ford, so many now at this point. How did it actually start going into that direction?
Well, I always felt, even coaching high school, that 400 meters was kind of like your quarterback in football. Mm. He needed 400 runners because those people can move up and down. Most 400, if you get a kid that's just strictly can only run the 400, he's not going to be a very good 400 runner. Mm-hmm. He's got to have the ability to drop down and run the 200 or move up and run the 800. He's got to have strengths in one of the areas, speed or endurance. If he just got a little bit of both, he's not going to be there. So I always felt like if you could develop the quarter milers, then you got some depth on your team. And the majority of my relay teams that won national championships, maybe only had 1 quarter mile on them, 2 at the most. Now, there were some luxury years that I may have more than that, but early on, I would have a half miler, I would have a quarter miler, I'd have an intermediate hurdler, mm-hmm. maybe another half miler or a 200 runner on there. So they all were developed as quarter milers basically in their training. But by tweaking a couple of days a week and let them go to the area, especially if you're a 200 runner, they would spend some of that time doing more speed work. If you're a half miler, they'd get up and run some things with the half milers. But they were basically had the ability to swing up and down. And that's why I could pull them and put them on my relay. And we never lost a beat if we usually put a half miler or a 200 runner because they were strong and they could do it. The half miler had the speed.
So I'm going to ask you a question that might, at face value, if you're just hearing the question, might seem disrespectful, but there's an end to the means here. Coach, you coach for a long time and have had unparalleled success. Today, we're in the year of 2024, there's more than one way to skin a cat, right? And so there's all these different ways of coaching a sprinter. And I don't necessarily disagree that there is maybe more than one way. What I don't like necessarily is when coaches attack another person's style, the way they do it.
Right.
Does your, I'm going to call it a philosophy, the way you coached quarter milers, when you're talking about the drop down to the 2 and the pickups to the 800s, that whole group. So it really was 100 through maybe even mile in this respect. Does what you did back then, does it still work? Would it still work today?
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt. In fact, it probably ought to work better today than, you know, if you go back all the way to, let me get the year right, it was the Montreal Olympics. I guess that would have been 72 or 76.
Yeah, 72. Olympics. I was thinking 76 in my head, yeah.
There was a guy named Juan Torreno. Won the 800,
mm-hmm.
came back and won the 400. Well, everybody said, "Oh, what a freaky steal! How could he do that? He doubled up and he was able to win the 800 and run the 400 too." And they just thought, "Well, that's just a freaky thing." Well, that should have been a tip off right there to tell us, "Hey, maybe we're not doing some things." Now, here's the key. Forever, all those books I was reading in the library at Hot Springs, and books I was reading at Little Rock Central on trainings, and I read everything out there. I looked at all the distance coaches. I knew what Liddy did, and I knew what Cerruti. I knew all the great people, how they trained, and all of them had different theories, and all of them had success to their degree. But you go over to the 400, and it just seemed like it was all the same thing, and that if you had better people, you're probably going to win because we're doing the same thing as those people that were lesser people. I mean, you know, it only figures if you got better than I got and we're doing the same thing, you're probably going to beat me. Mm-hmm. That's why the wishbone was put in football and the single wing got by the wing side. People figured out, hey, I got to do something different. Well, we had a chart in every coaching book, and even to today, you can find it. And in that chart, in fact, my training program used to call it percentage training because I knew that science is where coaches do not pay enough attention. Mm. Science and the laws of physics are so important in coaching that it's astounding that how they're ignored. But one of the scientific things is, how is the energy supplied for different events? Well, they had created this chart and had the 100, 200 for every event was listed, running event. And it put the percentage that was going to be required by the energy resources. You have two major things. You have aerobic, you have anaerobic. Aerobic is where there's available oxygen there for you to breathe in. You can breathe it. It's there. Anaerobic is where you run out of oxygen. You've run too fast. You can't take enough in. So you got to rely on the sugars and the glucose in the body. Well, on the 400, every book had it the same percent. 90% was going to be anaerobic and only 10% was going to be aerobic. So that gave the impression that, you know, doing some volume work, doing some slower running, building up your oxygen uptake was not important because only 10% of the race requires that. And just do speed work because 90% of it requires that. And that's what people did. And I did. And the 800 told you it was 66-33%, and the mile was 50-50. So you, if you were smart, you adjusted your training program to suit that. Mm-hmm. Well, I did that forever. So the distances that we run today never changed. It's just how we run them changed. Mm-hmm. Because surely by accident, and probably some of the greatest inventions in history came about by accident. Some of the products we have was a byproduct of something created for this, but turned out the byproduct turned out to be better. 1990, I met with Michael Johnson. Michael Johnson was the biggest kept secret in America. He could run 19 seconds in the 200. He was running 43 seconds in the 400. But by the end of the year, invariably, he got hurt. He got hurt at the conference meet or he got hurt at the NCAA meet. Never could make it to the national level to get the recognition he deserved. So we had a meeting and I said, "Mike, we got to do something because I want you to get to the NCAAs and win that and go on and get a career out of this thing." I said, you're the best 200, 400 runner that ever lived, and yet we can't get it out on the track." And he agreed. And it was not always the same thing. One was a broken bone. One was a quad. One was a hamstring. Hmm. Well, I said, "Let's try something." Our fall training, we emphasized running slower, building up our strength, endurance. So we're out on the grass and we're just doing some things slower. We're not doing anything that's probably going to get you hurt. We don't run that fast. And we're taking it easier. It's conditioning. It's what we call basic training. He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "What we're going to do when the other kids go into the second phase, which is going faster, running, you know, running fast 150s, fast 200s. We're not going to do that. We're going to stay in a slower mode. You're going to get more volume work. You're going to take shorter rest. I'm going to just keep you healthy, and you may have to sacrifice some early meets. But by April, when the weather's better and it's closer to the deal, we will start getting you ready, and maybe this slower approach will help. Well, man, he got in such great shape. It's unbelievable. He ran the fastest 400 in history that year. He ran 43 seconds in a meet in Waco in March, if I'm not mistaken. I know it was the fastest one that early in the year. And he ran a fast 200. Well, when April came around, I said, Mike, let's have a meeting. And I said, you know, we were going to switch over and you're going to start doing a little faster stuff. You're going to take, we're just going to cut down the amount of distance you're running, and we're going to not do as much and take longer rest. I said, I don't know if we need to do that. I said, you're PRing doing what we're doing. He said, yes, sir, you're right. He said, let's stay with this for a while. Well, make a long story short, I changed our training program. Hmm. So about that time, what's ironic, there was a research that came out of Australia, and they had finally, as smart as our scientists are, we could always put a kid on treadmill and figure out how his oxygen uptake, how he could, how much aerobic capacity that he had developed. You could test that, put a mask on him, do all these things. But it's very difficult to do anaerobic because you got to catch a kid out in action. Right. You got to draw blood. You got to test it, whatever. People, either because of experience, I don't want to take the time to do that, just never did it. Well, the Australians did it. They put test groups out. They went through all this. And lo and behold, that chart was changed. And they published it. And I looked at it and I said, oh, my gosh. Look down at the 400 instead of being 90 aerobic, 10%, 90 anaerobic and 10% aerobic, it was 60-40. Huh. Well, that's a big difference. It was 60 anaerobic, but it's gone up to 40% aerobic capacity, which meant you had to build up the you only can do that by taking either long runs, which I didn't want to do that often, or you just do repetition more with shorter rest. And I looked at Michael's training, and the best I could figure, he was right on 60-40 is what he was training on. So we were already doing what the research proved was correct. Well, I tell somebody, I said, and that was obvious. So he's the guy that set the world record. Why wouldn't it be correct? Well, lo and behold, about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, I was in a meeting in Las Vegas with Ralph Mann, who's our biomechanics guy for the U.S. track and field, and our medical doctor. I'm blanking the name just a minute. I apologize for that. Always each session, it was for sprinters and hurdlers. Mm-hmm. They were doing a little research project and present it as a paper. That particular one, he decided he was going to research a 400 energy supply. And lo and behold, his paper said 59-41. And I sat back and he said, and by the way, Clyde Hart is the only one doing this training. And that's what their research is proving, exactly what the Australians, it was off just by, I think, one percentage point or something. But since then, there's been several other same things, and it's all been within 1 or 2 points of the 60-40 deal. So basically, we just haven't been giving our kids. 400 runners today are trained more, the ones that are successful. Now, that's not to say there's going to be a guy that has super ability, will get out and run a real fast time, but you won't hear from him again. There's a reason for that. He's run out of strength at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. Was it ironic at the last Olympics that we did not place a guy in the 400? We had people running 44 seconds at the NCAA championship, and yet he's eliminated out with a 46. Almost 46 seconds, 45.6 in the first round. Mm-hmm. Well, it's just like the weight room. If you lift weights and you get a PR, and then you get injured and you lay off for a month to go back in there, you're not going to be able to lift what you can lift because you have lost strength. Well, the same thing on runners. If you build up that strength and you lay off it, so some of these guys would go out and they get in great shape, and then they start competing and they back off to stay fresh. Well, you got to reload. If you don't reload, you're going to lose it. And we learned that in a hurry. And Michael, we never run more than 3 to 4 at the max weeks without laying off, coming home, training for a week or two, and getting strong and go back and running another deal. So I don't believe in peaking. I think you just got to keep reloading.
Let's move to a different topic here. You know, we talked about you being at Baylor for 56 years and being highly successful. And I think about two of my, you've had a lot of great coaches on your staff. Two of my more favorite, Danny Brabham and Todd Harbor. I think of loyalty with them as well, was with you for a long time. Todd becomes the head coach after you retired. In 56 years, what kept you at Baylor? I have to assume you had other opportunities, other universities, maybe other thoughts of going back to Arkansas. I don't know. What kept you there for 56 years? This little, it's a small school and a small town. It's beautiful. I've been to Waco, but it's a hard place. You mentioned, you know, the cost of, you know, for recruiting, for the school, things like that. What kept you there all that time?
Well, I always, I love Baylor. I believe in Baylor's mission as a Christian education institution. I feel very strongly about that. And I think that Baylor has its place. It's developed a lot of young people, not only track people, but just young people. It's a good school, good place to work. Only one time in my whole 56 years did I interview for another job. I was called by Coach Barry Bryant. He had decided to upgrade his track program at Alabama. And the only reason he had decided to upgrade it was that he had lost the best hurdler football player in the state of Alabama, Richmond Flowers, who ended up playing for the Cowboys as well as University of Tennessee. His daddy had been governor of Alabama, and this kid signed with Tennessee because he had a track program and was allowing him to play football as well. And that made Bear Bryant, he said, I'll never lose another one. So he was going to do whatever he's going to do to not let that happen again. So he decided he was going to do all these things to build the track program, and new stadium, and go get a coach. Anyhow, I was asked to come to interview, and I actually took the job. And the main reason I did was that we had a terrible situation at Baylor. We had a football coach that he and I didn't see eye to eye, and I never not got along with any football coach, but for reasons I won't get into, it wasn't working, and he wasn't winning any football games, and it just wasn't a very happy environment. And so I told my wife, I'm going to go check this out, and I told Coach Bryant that I would, but I had to still go home and talk to my wife, but I felt like I would be in Alabama. Well, flying back home on the plane, I got to thinking, man, I don't know. Alabama, they'll give me the money to go all over everywhere and recruit. And it's going to take that to get the talent in there. You won't just find it in Alabama. You're going to have to be going all over the nation. You're going to have to be going overseas, and you're going to have to be getting kids, foreign athletes. In Waco, I can go within 100 miles and win a national championship. And literally, several of my relay teams that won national championships, I had kids that were not, none of them lived more than 100 miles from Waco, and some of them not even that far. So I thought about that. But the big turning point, when I came home and I told my wife, she said, well, I might want to tell you this. Your son, Scott, when I told him that you might be going to Alabama, he simply said, well, will he get to come home for Christmas? And that kind of shook me up, that he had no idea that I was going to do that. And I said, no, you tell him I won't miss Christmas, and I'm not going to take the job. And I did my call and explained that. And my wife, and I wish I could tell you exactly what she said, because she's a nice lady, but she said, you'll outlast that blankety blank in regular football. And I did. He was fired the next year. And so that was the only chance I took.
Wow.
I never even considered anything else.
That's a great lesson in priorities. It might have been more money, might have been more prestige. I don't know. I'm an SEC homer, so and Alabama was different then than it is now, and the SEC is different as well. But the priority of families, and also you mentioned faith and believing in the Baylor mission as well. Those priorities were higher than the bigger paycheck and the more money to go fly around and recruit everywhere, etc.
And my wife was a Baylor mm-hmm. and she had been a Golden Girl twirler, and she was a professor in the School of Business. And that just wasn't right for me to pull up and do that. But she would have done it and never looked back. Right. But she was right that I was leaving for the wrong reasons.
Right.
I just needed to do more.
Well, Coach, I've got three people that I'd like to get your opinions on. It's the three people that – so this whole month here in January, we're doing a Baylor month. So I've got three Baylor alums. And as I mentioned, I'm putting you on the anchor leg here. So you're wrapping up our Baylor series, if you will. And so we've heard from them, so I'd like to hear your opinions, your thoughts, your time with them as their coach. So let's start with, we kicked it off with our lead leg here, our current head coach at Baylor University, Mr. Mike Ford. What do you remember recruiting, coaching, and mentoring Mike Ford?
Well, Mike Ford was I used to tell people he was one of my foreign athletes because he was from New York. But that's not as far as we were getting him from. And Mike was a good sprinter, quarter miler, and really good long jumper. But I kind of decided that long jump is an event that you can get lots of injuries, and we didn't have that kind of depth. And I didn't really know how much Michael could help us in the long jump because I had a really good crew of long jumpers. So I determined Mike would run the four and the two. And Michael Ford was by far the most consistent leadoff runner on our 4x4 relays. If I'm not mistaken, I know he was on at least four or five that won national championships, indoors and outdoors. Mm-hmm. But Michael, I never had to worry about getting a good leadoff lane because he could run faster on the relay than he could open for some reason. I don't know whether it was more relaxed with the baton. And he was a good open 400, don't get mm-hmm. me wrong, but he was an outstanding leadoff runner.
What does it mean to you? You know, after you retired, Baylor great miler Todd Harbor becomes the head coach. And then once Todd retires, now great quarter miler Mike Ford, alumni, becomes head coach. What's it mean to you that, you know, Todd and now Mike Ford, guys that you worked with and are Bears just like you, continue to run the program as we move into the future?
Well, of course, Todd was an outstanding, one of the best this conference, the old conference, mm-hmm. Southwest Conference, ever had. He could run, beat anybody in 800, you could beat them in a mile, and a lot of people don't realize that he's still the cold holder of the American record, of the NCAA record. He ran under 4 minutes, ran 350.23, I believe.
Wow.
He and Jim Ryan had the same identical time.
I didn't know that.
For the collegiate record for a long time.
So let's talk about, let's go to the second leg here. Another, you know, it's hard to say another great Baylor 400 meter runner because the list is long here. Someone that's become a friend of mine through the end of his professional career and now into his own coaching career. Talk to us about Jeremy Warner.
Well, Jeremy was probably what people don't, well, I'm saying that, right? They may, but I'll just reiterate. Michael Johnson was voted the quarter miler of the decade of the 90s. Jeremy Warner was voted the quarter miler of the next decade of the 2000s. So for two decades back to back, we had the quarter miler voted as the best during those decades. Jeremy ended up with the third fastest 400. Mm-hmm. You got the
Wade Van Kirk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't thank the guy. He only did it the one time, set the world record. Mm-hmm. And Michael's second, and Jeremy is the third mm-hmm. on the quarter list. But as far as the number of times you run 43s, I think it's Michael and then Jeremy on the all-time list. Well, Jeremy was a, was different than Michael. People want to compare them. They're totally different two people. Jeremy had more success in high school than Michael in the 200. He was one of the top, if not the top, high school 200 runner, and towards the top in the 400. Michael was the second best in Texas in the 200. So they were just different. Both of them had the same quality of being hard workers, dedicated, but it just came in with a little bit different credentials, different running style. Jeremy was just taller, relaxed, beautiful runner. Michael had the different running style that the worst thing can happen. I remember Dwight Stones, high jumper, TV analyst, kept making a comment, once Michael Johnson learns to write running style, he's going to be great.
Right.
And I thought, and here's a guy talking. So I ran into Dwight later after that. And I said, Dwight, I want you to do something. Do me a favor. Before you make that comment again, when you do something, I want you to Google up, you'll find it, and watch Jesse Owens run. And then you make that comment about Jesse Owens, because you're talking Michael Johnson. You can cover with your hands the upper body of Michael Johnson and Jesse Owens, and the bottom is identical. It's identical. It looks like a road runner. The legs are turning over so quick there, but their upright is exactly the same. He said, well, I hadn't thought about that. I said, well, you need to, because Michael just ran different. He wasn't running wrong.
Yeah.
Yes, his stride was slightly shorter than most of the people, but his stride was a lot quicker than most people. So it's a give and take situation. So anyhow, that's and then later I went to a conference in Finland. And I did my lecture, and I was sitting back, and a Russian was talking, and there had to be an interpreter because I couldn't understand him. And one of the things he said, that they had done research, and this was early on before Michael became really, well, he wasn't the world record holder, and he was just kind of emerging onto the scene, but people were taking notice, and the Russians certainly had taken notice, and they said they had analyzed that the running style of different runners, and they had come to the conclusion that the perfect running style was more erect with a slightly shorter stride. Isn't that something? And I looked at the guy and said, that's Michael Johnson. I said, he knows that too, but he's not going to use his name. But he said that all their studies on force on the track and what was the most efficient was to run more. So he's hitting Jesse Owens and Michael Johnson, which is two pretty good guys to hang out with.
Not bad. Not bad. All right. This next guy, more known as a pole vaulter as a Baylor Bear, but I actually know the inside track. He actually was a 300 hurdler coming down to your ways, and he's obviously very near and dear to my heart and our hearts here at Gill Athletics, Mr. David Hodge.
David Hodge. I got to tell you about David.
Please, please do.
David shows up, redheaded, skinny kid. I call him 14-14 because he pole vault, he came in with 14-foot pole vault, if I'm not mistaken,
about right.
14 seconds in the hurdles, or maybe 14-plus something. But that was his two events. He was a walk-on. And the first day, if I'm not mistaken, he sprains his ankle going over a hurdle or trying to go over a hurdle. And I tell David, I don't want to discourage him. I don't want him quitting. He's a walk-on kid. Get treatment. And David, I want you to go over to the pole vault pit area with the vaulters and catch their vaulting pole, because we don't want that pole to get damaged, those fiberglass poles. He said, okay. He goes over, and that's his job. The vaulters vault, David catches the pole. Well, after several weeks, I thought, David's ankle ought to be well, but now he can start working some of these hurdles, because I thought maybe that might be his best event. Well, I can't get him away from there now, because he's already planting the pole, and he's doing some things. I said, just stay over there. Well, of course, the rest is history. I think his PR was 18.5, maybe. placed in the top three at the NCAA meet in the vault. But I kid him, the ambition of most track guys was to win a watch at a track meet. Mm-hmm. Get a watch. David had never won a watch pole vaulting, though he was vaulting 18 foot when 18 foot was unbelievable, mm-hmm. but never got a watch. Well, the week before the Drake relays, I'm planning to run a shuttle hurdle relay. I got three really good legs, but my fourth guy, I can't even remember if I had a fourth guy, is hurt, but I don't have one. And the other three guys says, "Coach, we sure want to run that." And I said, "Yeah, we got to have a fourth leg." Then I'm thinking, David Hodge, ran the hurdles in high school. So I called David over and I said, "David, the shuttle hurdles are the day before the pole vault, if I'm not mistaken. He wasn't going to interfere with his vaulting. And so I want you to come over and see if you can get over a college hurdle." And he could. He could jump it and get over. And he got better on Tuesday. He was doing a little better than he did on Monday. Wednesday, he was actually getting over, I think, three hurdles, maybe five, and not hitting but maybe two or three of them at a time. And I said, "Okay, David, we're going for it. You're going to run on the shuttle hurdle relay." And he said, "Seriously?" I said, "Seriously, David." And he was excited about it. He really was. He may tell a different story now, but I thought he was excited about it. Well, make a long story short, we win the shuttle hurdle relay, and he gets a Drake relay watch. And that's the only watch the kid ever got at Baylor University. So I always tell people, you know.
Because of the hurdles, not pole vaulting.
That's right. The high hurdles.
I love
and,
that.
And as cheap as David is, he's probably still wearing that watch.
He's not wearing that watch, but you are correct. I always look at his watch and I'm like, man, you know, you can get a little bit nice. I mean, you don't have to go Rolex here, David. I get that. But you could have a little bit nicer.
Seriously about David. We appreciate David not only as a former athlete at Baylor, but as an alumni, he's helped us tremendously with our track program. If he hadn't helped us with the new track facility, it probably not would have happened with the Gill equipment and everything that we've got going. David was so instrumental in his whole family, and his son Ryan now is mm-hmm. still running, and we had his future wife as a track girl. So Baylor's been good, and we love David and appreciate him so much.
He is Baylor through and through. He is. Five kids that also go to Baylor. The youngest meets his wife at Baylor. He met his wife at Baylor. It is quite amazing, the Baylor love there for sure. Well, thank you for those opinions on those three great Baylor gentlemen. It's what's interesting to me, you know, I say this a lot with track coaches that, you know, 99% of the young people that you coach are not going to go on to be professional in track and field. Now you may buck that trend a little bit, but still the vast majority of athletes that you coach did not go pro. That's a very small slice that goes pro, but every kid you coach goes on to be a mother, a father, a business owner, a clergyman, et cetera. And so what's unique about those three individuals to me is, you know, two of them did go on to have a long professional career, Michael and Jeremy. Michael now is a business owner and analyst. Jeremy is now coaching himself in high school, doing a great job. And David, as a business owner here at Gill Athletics, to me, it's just a great representation of the positive impact that you make as a track coach, that these three gentlemen go on to have pretty varied experiences, but wildly successful in each one of those experiences. It really shows what the impact a coach has on young people.
Yes, and Jeremy's got a daughter that's a freshman mm-hmm. on the track team.
That's right. Oh, that's right. I forgot she's at Baylor too. That's right. Well, Coach, you know, it's not lost on me the responsibility that I have as the host of this podcast here. I mentioned, you know, we're 250 plus coaches and, you know, from first year coaches, heck, we had an athlete on the show who wasn't even a coach yet, all the way to guys and gals like you that have been coaching for a long time. And, you know, one of the responsibilities I take specifically for a coach in your position is representing a lot of people that have either not had the opportunity to tell you this, maybe have been too hesitant to come tell you in person, but I represent thousands and thousands of coaches and athletes to say thank you. You know, the positive impact you make on a kid, on a young kid, an 18 to 22 year old at Baylor, and heck, the 14 and 18 year olds that you had at Little Rock Central as well. It's immeasurable. It really is. Your legacy is being carried out by the Jeremy who's coaching now. Heck, it's carried out by David and the impact that he makes on us here at Gill as well. So I just want to say thank you from thousands and thousands of people for the positive impact that you have made. And what's awesome is that you continue to make today.
Mike, can you see the book?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Is that the book?
Now that's a book and it's designed for the high schools.
Okay.
Although anybody can use it because it tells a whole training program. And then at each chapter that's talking about our program, it tells how you can use this and convert it down to the high school level, what changes need to be made. It's really very few changes. It's just adjustment of some times.
Hold it up just a little bit more.
But hold
it up just a little bit more. So it's called Breaking Down the Wall. I can find this at Amazon if I Google.
Amazon.
Yep, perfect. All right, Breaking Down the Wall. We got to go find them.
And I got into this by accident. Derek Leininger,
mm-hmm.
doctor, he was a former high school track coach in Indiana. And now he has his doctorate and he's a school principal. He came up with this idea. He'd been using our training program. And he was upset because there were so many what he and I refer to as false prophets preaching that you don't have to do the work, you can just do sprinting, that our training method is too hard, it causes kids to quit track and field because they're not willing to do that kind of work, etc., which is mm-hmm. a bunch of baloney. The females do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, so he came to Waco and spent a week just going to interview me. Well, it ended up, we became co-authors of it. And he did a lot of research on things that I had never done. And it verifies what our program means. So we're happy.
So if you're listening, why are you still listening? You should be going to Amazon right now, Breaking Down the Wall. You've got to go check this book out. That's there's years and years of mistakes. there's years and years of success, all broken down for you right there and Breaking Down the Wall.
I'm not saying it just because I'm involved with it, but it's the best training book on the 400 that I've by far I've ever done because it covers the reasons why you do it and how you do it, all the drills and all the stuff. And if you don't like it, don't do it. But I think you will.
Well, the good coaches I know are continually working on their coaching education. This sounds like a great opportunity to continue that coaching education. Coach Hartman, thank you so much. You know, as a former coach myself, you know, I've always held you in high esteem and, you know, being working with David and being friends with David, you know, I know the impact you've made on him, which the impact you made on us. So I'm just so grateful for your time today to be able to learn your journey and be able to share it with our listeners.
Mike, you didn't mention your buddy Danny Brabble.
I did. I said Danny and Todd are the two. You know, when I think about loyalty and just, you know, consistency, man, love those guys. Absolutely.
Well, Danny's doing well. He hasn't aged a day. Plays golf, and I see him occasionally. But he was a great athlete, and I know y'all were good friends. And
absolutely
appreciate you so much. And you say hello to David and family for me.
I will, man. Thank you so much, Coach. Appreciate you again for being here today.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Yes, sir.
The goal is to appreciate the coach, the ones who point people most. Every season needs a voice of reason, speaking the growth. Got a prep for you, carry the load. It's coffee to the soul for those of us who stay on the go. Proper handoff to stay in the zone. What you packing for the road? There's more than one way to go. Take notes, that's paying your toll. It ain't practice if your purpose ain't clear. It can't happen till you listen with both ears. Can't mentor without a mentor's years of experience, you can reinvent those years. Every plan's got a standard to live up to, and the price sacrifice, can you give up you? It's a choice and a fight, not a win or lose. It's not a ploy, but advice so y'all can make more moves. It's not about how to, it's all about why. You don't know till you know who you are inside. 6 million ways to tie, choose none. So we all cross the finish line, the work ain't done. So we learn from the experts, we all gotta put in the legwork. Gill Athletics is a network, it's all about connections. Put together for the profession, so every track coach could be a blessing.